Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. Standing, same-sex marriage, and DOMA edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 26, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Hollingsworth v. Perry and United States v. Windsor. Both cases concern the constitutionality of same-sex marriages. Perry considered whether the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment prohibits California from defining marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and whether the petitioners have standing to sue in the case. The questions in Windsor were whether Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, violates equal protection, whether the executive branch's agreement with the lower court deprives the Supreme Court of jurisdiction, and whether one of the parties had standing to sue in the case. In Perry, in an opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the Supreme Court held by a vote of 5-4 that petitioners did not have standing to appeal the district court's order striking down Proposition 8, and that the Supreme Court therefore could not reach the merits of the dispute. The court remanded the case to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit with instructions to dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction. Justices Scalia, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan joined the majority opinion. Justice Kennedy filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Thomas, Alito, and Sotomayor. In Windsor, in an opinion delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that it had jurisdiction to consider the case, that Section 3 of DOMA violates equal protection under the Fifth Amendment, and is therefore unconstitutional. Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined the majority opinion. Chief Justice Roberts filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Scalia filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Thomas joined, in which the Chief joined in Part 1. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Thomas joined in Parts 2 and 3. To discuss the cases, we have Carrie Severino, who is Chief Counsel and Policy Director of the Judicial Crisis Network, and John Adler, who is a professor of law and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Ms. Severino and Professor Adler.
I want to just start by giving a quick summary of the case, because facts of the case, well, probably they'll be familiar to a lot of people, are worth reviewing and are relevant to the holding and to some of the details of how it came down. So this, we're starting with the case of U.S. versus Windsor. This is a case coming out of New York State involving two women who were married in Canada, in a marriage that was legal in Canada at the time. Then they moved to New York, where same-sex marriage is now legal. And Edith Windsor's partner died, Thea Spire, and she left her estate to Edith in her will. Now, if they had been married, well, they were married, if they were married under New York law, that they wanted their estate to pass to Windsor under federal law for the sake of federal taxes. So if this was just a gift between two unmarried individuals, there would be an estate tax involved. Whereas if this was passing from one spouse to another under federal law, approximately $300,000 worth of taxes here would have been avoided. So that's why Windsor is feeling aggrieved by the Defense of Marriage Act in this case. The key provision of the Defense of Marriage Act is the one that defines, for purposes of federal law, the meaning of marriage. There's two provisions. One, it talks about full faith and credit clause and whether states have to recognize each other's marriages. That's not at issue here. It's really just the definition of marriage under federal law, including, it's for the purposes of the state, federal estate tax law, but it also would include a whole range of federal benefits in the way military couples were treated, Medicaid, or you name it. There's a lot of places in federal law where marriage is defined. So DOMA says it was passed in the wake of states just starting to think about legalizing same-sex marriage. The reasoning behind passing it was sort of at issue in this case, either to nationalize one definition so that all the states had a same definition, at least for the purposes of federal law, or, as the majority in this case alleges, purposely discriminate against a group of people. And that's a real fundamental difference between the majority and the dissent in these cases. So I'll move into now what the majority opinion held. Well, actually, let me quick go into one other aspect of the case, which is how it was brought up, because this is important, that Windsor sued to not have to pay that $300,000, and when she first brought the lawsuit, the federal government was opposed to her, defending the statute, defending DOMA. They said, no, you still have to do this, money is due to us. The federal government rather famously changed course in its defense of DOMA and decided it did not want to defend DOMA any further, and so by the time her case was appealed to the Second Circuit and then to the Supreme Court, the federal government was now agreeing with Edith Windsor that it did not owe her the money. It still hadn't paid her back that $300,000 she was forced to pay, but it agreed that they didn't have to, DOMA was unconstitutional. In fact, one of the case makes a big deal of if the motion to dismiss, which explicitly asked them not to dismiss the case because the federal government agreed with Edith Windsor. So there was a standing question whether it was actually a controversy here in the first place if you've got parties on both sides of the case that agree. So because the federal government, in the form of the Department of Justice, wasn't defending this case, Congress stepped in to defend it. The Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group was created by the House in order to defend the law in the absence of executive branch defense, and that group appointed Paul Clement to bring these defenses throughout the country whenever DOMA was challenged, but the federal government was refusing to defend it. So there's three parties involved in this case: Windsor, who is the woman who wants to receive her estate tax refund on this case, the federal government, which is technically opposed to her but agrees with her, and then the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, which is actually defending the statute. So Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion of the court, and in that opinion, it finds that there is standing to bring the lawsuit, and in light of that, decides on a sort of hybrid rationale that is sort of part federalism, part equal protection arguments. He talks about the fact that the federal government can make some definitions regarding the meaning of marriage for the purposes of federal law, but that the states have the traditional interest in role in defining and regulating marriage. He quotes Lawrence versus Texas and talks about the state's interest in private consensual intimacy as part of an element in a personal bond that's more enduring. He likes going and quoting his own language there. And then he also points to two different ways in which that gets brought in to the Equal Protection Clause. He says once a state has defined something as marriage, the federal government can't single out one type of lawful marriage as lesser than another. So setting aside the fact that DOMA was actually passed before any states had a lawful same-sex marriage, he said that they're creating two contradictory marriage regimes within the same state. And he said that the states are allowed to confer this dignity as an exercise of their sovereign power. So these are federalist-sounding kind of terms that he uses. But he also talks about it in terms of Equal Protection Clause-type language. He waxes eloquent about the importance in same-sex marriages, importance to tens of thousands of children who are being raised by same-sex couples. He talks about the disapproval of the class and concludes really from my perspective, a selective reading of legislative history, that the avowed purpose and practical effect of the law here are to impose a disadvantage, create a separate second-class status, and a stigma on everyone in same-sex marriages. Now, I think legislative history contains a lot of different things in it, which is why it inevitably becomes a selective type reading. But then by his conclusion, he goes back and starts sounding more like he's resting this on a federalism grounds. He talks about These are same-sex marriages made lawful by the state and deemed by the state entitled to recognition and protection, and then the state finds that to be dignified and proper, and now we're injuring people who the state, by its marriage laws, sought to protect in personhood dignity, and it's confining its holding to those lawful marriages. So it's kind of a mix of this federalism and equal protection type argument. The Chief Justice dissented and wrote his own dissent, chiefly pointing out the limits on this decision, particularly the fact that it doesn't purport to go farther than just overturning DOMA on this ground, on these federalist-type grounds, and it doesn't have before it the entire broad sweep of every other law in the states in the country. Justice Scalia issues a even more biting than normal dissent, arguing with Chief Justice joined as well as Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, that there was no standing to bring the case here, and he talks about the essential nature of having a controversy when you have a case in controversy as required for Article III standing, and really criticizes the majority opinion for really relegating standing to almost a prudential question when, in fact, standing is such a fundamental constitutional question that a court can even raise it sua sponte, even if the litigants don't raise it. That's something that the court raises themselves. So very critical that they've made that almost a prudential matter when it really should be a mandatory question because it goes to the constitutional right. And I'll just quickly read Justice Scalia's intro to his thing because this summarizes his dissent, which is, this case is about power. It's about the power of our people to govern themselves and the power of the court to pronounce the law. And today's opinion aggrandizes the latter, the power of the court, with a predictable consequence of diminishing the former. So it's about diminishing the power of the people to govern themselves while the court is aggregating that power to itself. I'll point out, though, at least that this does leave the power to a certain extent in the hands of the people of the individual states, at least for now, but there's really the writing on the wall with this equal protection clause language that the court may choose to take this one step further in the next case.
All righty. Well, first, it's a pleasure to be here. Let me just make a few comments about Windsor. Let me also just, I guess as a matter of disclosure, I participated in an amicus brief law professors urging the court to consider federalism issues in analyzing DOMA and arguing that there would not be a sufficient federal interest to justify DOMA, but taking no position on Perry or what interest states might have. Now, I don't know whether or not our brief was influential or not, but certainly pleased to see as much discussion of federalism as there was in Kennedy's opinion, although I should note that this is a very Kennedy opinion. There's no The analysis is sweeping and vague. It's like a lot of Kennedy opinions. It's the sort of thing that as a law professor, you hope never to see from a student, because what you want from a student is a very clear identification of what's the question, what's the rule, apply the rule. We don't get any of that. We don't get, for example, any identification of what level of scrutiny to be applied, whether we're talking about determinations based on sexual preference or even distinctions in the context of marriage. And the opinion almost goes out of its way to avoid the sort of buzzwords that would give a clue as to how to fit this into our traditional doctrinal categories. And we've seen this before. Justice Kennedy's opinion in Lawrence has a very similar quality of a lot of sweeping language, but when you finish the opinion, you're left without any clear direction as whether or not it was rational basis or some form of heightened scrutiny. In terms of the nature of the holding, I think it's quite limited and almost as limited as could be given the court's conclusion that DOMA was struck down. The court, Kennedy stressed that the federal interest in defining marriage as such is really quite limited. He notes that there are special cases in which a federal definition of marriage might be necessary to further a very clear federal interest. And so one example that is noted is in immigration law, where a marriage that is recognized by a state but that the federal government believes was entered into fraudulently does not have to be recognized for purposes of immigration the federal government does not have to acknowledge it and allow that marriage to alter someone's immigration status. So the court notes that in those sorts of narrow instances could have a sufficient interest. But what's different here is here Congress sought to redefine the definition of marriage and of a spouse for some 1,000 or so statutes across the board all at once, and the unifying federal interest in that really was defending marriage as it has traditionally been known. And in Kennedy's view, in the majority's view, that's not something that the federal government has an interest in. And I think that is certainly significant, and it is notable that the court does, or Kennedy does, repeatedly come back to these federalist notions. On the jurisdictional point, what's really interesting here in terms of the jurisdictional question in the case is that it's a very close case whether or not the court had jurisdiction, whether or not Blagg had a standing in this case. Six justices ultimately conclude that there was jurisdiction. In addition to the majority, Justice Alito also believed that jurisdiction should be found here. And Justice Alito also notes that it's odd that the court found jurisdiction in this case, but as we'll talk about in a minute, found that there was no jurisdiction in the Proposition 8 case because jurisdiction is tougher in Windsor than in Prop 8. And he suggests that if jurisdiction were only to have been found in one of the cases, it probably should have been the reverse. And I think he's right on that, although I do believe the court did have jurisdiction in both cases. Something else that I just have to note in Justice Alito's dissent, everyone should take a look at footnote 7 if for no other reason than Justice Alito, his somewhat arch dismissal of the way the trial court had purported to make findings of fact about what are really some broad philosophical questions about the nature of marriage and the nature of the family. And he concludes with I think, a well-deserved swipe at many of my colleagues at the Academy for suggesting that the Supreme Court was somehow bound by these conclusions that Judge Walker had characterized as findings of fact, and ends the footnote with the line, "Only an arrogant legal culture that has lost all appreciation of its own limitations could take such a suggestion seriously." So I got quite a chuckle out of that. Last point I wanted to make is that there are some things that the court did not decide that we will see litigation on almost right away. One is the other part of the Defense of Marriage Act, the part that allows states to not extend full faith and credit to same-sex marriages performed in other states. So a state like Ohio, in which I reside, where there's a constitutional amendment limiting marriage to the union of a man and a woman, Ohio does not have to recognize a same-sex marriage performed lawfully in, say, New York or District of Columbia. So that was not an issue here. Also, the majority never addresses the question of what would happen if a couple is lawfully married in one state, moves to a state that does not recognize same-sex marriage. Would the federal government be allowed to say, your domicile doesn't recognize the marriage, so we do not, or would the federal recognition of the marriage kind of attach at the moment of marriage and forever follow that couple? I would be inclined to say that the latter result is more likely the eventual result, but the court never addresses that point, even after Justice Scalia in dissent notes that this is one of the questions that its resolution of the case leaves open. And I will stop there.
Proposition 8 is the case coming out of California. In that state, there was actually two different attempts to make the marriage just between a man and a woman in the state. First, there was a proposition that went through that as a matter of law, simply said as a matter of law, they have all of these benefits, but it's not going to be called marriage. That was ultimately struck down by the California Supreme Court that said the California Equal Protection Clause in its own constitution requires that the definition not be limited to marriage between a man and a woman. While that case was even going through the courts, there was a group trying to then work through Proposition 8, which would have amended the California Constitution itself to make marriage just between a man and a woman. In that proposition, just a matter of months after the court determined that the California Constitution required marriage to be extended to same-sex couples, Proposition 8 went through, which then amended the Constitution, effectively overturned the California Supreme Court decision. Then this case went through the California District Court, the federal district court, and they were trying to claim that this was an equal protection violation under the federal constitution. So that's the case that we have here today. Now, the district court, in a very famous decision, decided that the Equal Protection Clause does require marriage to be extended to same-sex couples. That was Judge John Walker's decision, and there were a lot of criticism of the way he ran the trial, but it was nonetheless the final ruling there, and then that was appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court. Now, what's interesting is that at the district court level, the governor and the attorney general of California were the ones who were technically defending this case. But much like the DOMA decision, they determined that they did not want to defend Proposition 8's constitutionality. The governor himself took no position on the issue, but the attorney general claimed it was unconstitutional. So he was in exactly the position that the Obama administration was in Windsor. So in that case, instead of having the bipartisan legal advisor group intervene, there was a group of Proposition 8 proponents who intervened, and they're the ones who effectively were defending the law during the 12-day trial and during district court level of that case. Then at the appellate level, the governor and attorney general declined to appeal the case, but the Proposition 8 defenders wanted to continue the case up to the Ninth Circuit. When the Ninth Circuit got the case, they were concerned about standing issues, so they certified a question to the California Supreme Court asking whether, in the absence of the governor or the attorney general defending this case, whether these proponents of the initiative could do so. And the California Supreme Court issued the ruling that is what this case turns on, effectively, and that is they said that when you have a post-election challenge to a voter-approved initiative measure, the official proponents of the initiative are authorized under California law to appear and assert the state's interest in the initiative's validity and appeal a judgment invalidating the measure when the public officials who ordinarily defend the measure or appeal such a judgment decline to do so. So as a matter of California law, and I believe they found this as a matter of the California Constitution as well as the California Election Code, the initiative proponents are authorized to bring this case. So then the Ninth Circuit found that it did violate the Equal Protection Clause under a much narrower theory than the district court did, and that a decision was appealed to the Supreme Court. This one was disposed of on standing grounds, and this was a decision by the Chief Justice, joined by the liberal members of the court, with Justice Kennedy writing the dissent, joined by Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito. As I said, this case ultimately did end up turning on standing. Article 3 standing requires the litigant to prove that they have a concrete and particularized injury that's traceable to the challenged conduct and likely to be redressed by the favorable judicial decision. So this court is focused on the lack of particularized injury to the parties here. They said, look, these proponents may be committed, deeply committed to upholding Proposition 8, but they have no direct stake in the appeal and only the same generalized grievance that any other citizen would have. The proponents, which Kennedy's dissent agreed with, claimed they have a unique interest because the state does not have to show a particularized interest. The state has its own interest in defending the laws. And in this case, the California law gave to the proponents of Proposition 8, effectively accorded to them that interest. That was the line that the California Supreme Court took, and that was the argument that was accepted by the Kennedy dissent. Majority opinion, on the other hand, claimed that this right given them to them by the California Supreme Court only gives them the right to go to the court and make arguments, but it doesn't make them de facto public officials or agents of the state. He talks a lot about the rule of agency and how they couldn't be agents because they're not authorized to do so, and they're not formal agents, they're not de facto agents of the state, and therefore that they can't aid in this litigation. He said there are cases that we've allowed third parties to litigate on behalf of the state, but they have to have a direct interest in these, or direct injury involved, and these people do not have an actual injury in the case. So based on that, the Chief Justice, along with Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, claimed that there was no standing in this case to bring the appeal. You know, really, it was only the appeal that was at issue here, and so the presumption, I guess, is that this goes back to the district court as and that decision would stand. The curious thing is that the district court decision stands on, first of all, a equal protection theory that no other court has gone as far as that in stating in terms of requiring same-sex marriage. Second of all, it's complicated in that it's not clear whether there would have been standing at the district court given the governor and the attorney general's unwillingness to defend the law at that point. That kind of intersects with Windsor in terms of the way that the federal government was on the same side. There's not this controversy going on, but in that case, you have them just laying down their arms and refusing to bring the case as opposed to trying to continue a case that they've already won. Sort of the flip side. And there's also the question of what the breadth of application of this decision is, because it was only in the Northern District of California that the district court opinion would hold. Can this be applied elsewhere in the state when the Ninth Circuit decision has been vacated? That's a serious question in and of itself. And just to comment a little bit from Kennedy's dissent, he, again, adopts the California Supreme Court's analysis, and he also talks a lot about how this undermines the initiative process because it would require the governor and the attorney general to cooperate in defending a law or a constitutional amendment passed by initiative, where, as he said, the very purpose of the initiative process is to have access to government when you feel that your governor and or other elected officials are not affecting the will of the people. So the people have a direct access to government rather than having to go through their elected officials. He says, the essence of democracy is that the right to make law rests in the people and flows to the government, not the other way around. That freedom resides first in the people without need for a grant for government. So he criticizes the idea that they would need to have a specific grant from the government to be able to defend this initiative when, in fact, the California Supreme Court has given them that authority. So I'll turn it over to Jonathan to talk further about this case.
Sure. I mean, the Perry case, certainly the lineup is a bit odd. We have, as Carrie noted, the Chief Justice joined by Scalia, Ginsburg, Kagan, and Breyer, finding no standing, and a divided decision on standing in which Ginsburg, Kagan, and Breyer all believe that there isn't standing when other justices think there is something quite odd and unusual. It's also a bit odd in this case because, as I noted, I think most observers would have assumed that the jurisdictional question was closer and more difficult in Windsor than it was here. And that's because, as a general matter, the sorts of interests that can support Article III standing are often a function of state law. Certainly, if we're thinking about property interests, the infringement of which can be an injury for Article III purposes, the court has made clear that it looks to property as defined by state law. And if we're talking about a right that is integral to the structure of a state's government and the operations of a state government, one would think that the state's understanding of how the state allows its citizens to vindicate their interests through referendum process and the like would satisfy federal courts for standing purposes. And it's a bit odd for federal courts to impose a particular procedural requirement or a particular type of agency relationship in order for a state to determine a standing. But the practical result of this decision, combined with Windsor, is to leave the question of same-sex marriage in the states. As Carrie noted, there are some real questions about what happens to Judge Walker's ruling at the trial court and the scope of its mandate. Typically, district courts do not have, or the mandate of a district court opinion does not apply to those who are not parties to the case. You know, although the parties in the litigation certainly wanted a statewide mandate, we don't usually think of a district court mandate as having that sort of effect. And so that will certainly have to be dealt with more broadly. I think the broader implication of this opinion, again, as Carrie noted, is that it really creates a very interesting situation for the two dozen or so states that have referendum processes provided for in their state constitutions. Because the whole point of those processes is to give citizens the ability to control and discipline their elected representatives. And if citizens believe that the legislature or the state executive is not faithfully following the wishes of the citizens, it provides a means for citizens to directly either see legislation enacted or, as in the case is in many states, to directly amend the state constitution. It would seem one possible consequence of the majority opinion is that state officials will be able to frustrate these efforts in many states across a wide range of issues by simply refusing to defend challenges to referenda and initiatives in federal court. And that would really be an odd result, and certainly could have a significant impact on quite a few states. Now, one last point I'll make, because I'm sure it would otherwise come up in the questions, is what do we make of this odd lineup? Only three justices would have found standing in both cases: Kennedy, Alito, and Sotomayor. And Justices Scalia and Roberts would have found standing in neither case. The remaining justices, Thomas, Breyer, Kagan, and Ginsburg, split on where they found standing. And so one bit of speculation that we're going to, I'm sure, see for quite some time is whether or not any of the standing votes were strategic. In particular, whether or not any of the justices that voted against standing in Perry did so because they were afraid of the result. And, you know, there will be some time before we know, but I will just underline again the anomaly of Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Ginsburg, justices that are ready to find standing in almost any conceivable circumstance, voting against standing here, even when a state Supreme Court had unanimously held that the requirements or the necessary interests for standing under state law would have been met. And I think that certainly leads to the suspicion that had this case gone to the merits, Justice Kennedy was not ready at this point in time to declare that the Constitution requires states to recognize same-sex marriage. And you know, if so, it will certainly be interesting to see how this court deals with what are the inevitable follow-on cases when litigants challenge Section 2 of DOMA or challenge other state provisions directly.
One quick response to kind of pair up the two cases. I think the bottom line here is that we don't see that same-sex marriage advocates were hoping they would get the justices to imposing a national definition of marriage. We don't get that. Even in the case of DOMA, it still relies somewhat on the states. And the second interesting point is that we are seeing something we wouldn't have seen 30 years ago. It would be hard to imagine that such a contentious policy issue is being decided on federalism grounds. So that's, I guess, maybe is my silver lining on this. The question is, to me, is that Jonathan kind of hinted at when he talked about what happens when you move from one state to another is, there's language in this decision that says we don't want to have two different regimes in the Windsor decision, that is, two different regimes within a state, and it's noxious that the federal government would be trying to create that. But we have a potential of doing exactly that if, as I fear may happen, we have just fair weather federalists on the court, where in this decision they're willing to look at the state law. But the next case where, say, you have someone who gets married in New York and moves to North Carolina, now what happens with their estate? Now what happens with their federal benefits? I think you could easily see those two regimes being reenacted just with the federal government carrying on the benefits. You could have New York become the new Las Vegas. Everyone goes there to get married, and then you can transfer those benefits throughout the country. So, again, I'm heartened to see some at least lip service, hopefully more than that, being paid to federalism. I hope it's something that will be enduring and not just a convenient way of limiting the decision today, when a lot of language in Kennedy's opinion points to the lack of rational basis that he sees for traditional definition of marriage, which really is the death knell for that under equal protection analysis whenever he gets the case before him where he's willing to do that. I'm not sure, you know, whether that's a matter of poll numbers or a certain amount of time that will have to elapse before he would want to extend his analysis there.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.